Hello, it's Tuesday, May the 26th, 2009. On today's podcast, the UN Security Council convenes to debate North Korea's continued nuclear testing.
Shook the ground about 130 miles away in a city on the Chinese-North Korean border. It was clearly a powerful blast and clearly shows that North Korea's nuclear technology has come along quite nicely as far as the North Koreans are concerned.
Alan Johnson gets the lead in the electoral reform debate. How a lump of flint can challenge creationist history. At the Hay Festival, we have a lesson in Pestonianism. We'll explain what that is later. And Island Records celebrates 50 years with memories of Bob Marley's first recordings for the label.
They played me all the tracks. The first track they played me was Slave Driver. I remember thinking, wow, this is incredible.
First, a news update and a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
The United Nations has strongly condemned North Korea for its underground test of a powerful nuclear device. The UN Security Council said the test was a clear violation of a 2006 resolution banning the country from conducting nuclear development. Meanwhile, Barack Obama has given assurances to Japan and South Korea that they have the full support of US defences against any possible North Korean aggression. North Korea accuses the US of hostility and says its army and people are ready to defeat an American invasion. More to come on this later in Guardian Daily. A Conservative government would boost the power of Parliament and cut back the role of the Prime Minister, according to David Cameron. Writing in today's Guardian, Cameron sets out the proposals he believes will restore public faith in politics. Other plans include fixed-term parliaments and more free votes for MPs. Read the full article at guardian.co.uk/politics. France's Church of Scientology is on trial in Paris today on charges of organised fraud. It's accused of targeting vulnerable people for commercial gain. While some countries, such as the US, consider Scientology a religion, France categorises it as a sect. The case could lead to the shutdown of the organisation's bookshop and jail for its top members in France. In sport, Burnley are back in the top flight of English football after an absence of 33 years. They beat Sheffield United by a goal to nil at Wembley yesterday and join the other newly promoted sides, Birmingham and Wolverhampton Wanderers, in the Premier League next season. Now for a look at today's papers, and the Independent leads with news that oil giant Shell to stand trial in New York, accused of complicity in the execution of a Nigerian environmental activist. The Telegraph's latest revelation in its expenses investigation is that the husband of a Labour MP has received more than £5,000 for providing tax advice to ministers, including David Miliband. Meanwhile, The Sun turns its expenses fury on members of the European Parliament, who can claim over £350,000 a year without producing any receipts. The Times has the latest twist in the story that's gripped the literary world. Oxford's professor of poetry has resigned after only 9 days following revelations of a smear campaign she conducted against her rival for the post. And finally, according to The Mirror, Newcastle's caretaker manager Alan Shearer will be offered a 4-year contract with a relegated club, and he'll put the whole squad up for sale. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
I condemn North Korea's nuclear test in the strongest terms, the words of Gordon Brown, and a reckless challenge to the international community, the response by Barack Obama. North Korea has at least brought together a united global response to its latest underground nuclear test. China and Russia have called for talks, and the UN Security Council has convened for an emergency debate. The Guardian's Justin McCurry is in Tokyo. He says this latest test was on the scale of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945.
By some estimates, it's between 10 and 20 times more powerful than the device that was tested in 2006. It apparently shook the ground about 130 miles away in a city on the Chinese-North Korean border. So it was clearly a powerful blast and clearly shows that in those 3 years that North Korea's nuclear technology has come along quite nicely as far as the North Koreans are concerned. But obviously it's a cause for concern for the rest of the region and indeed the wider world.
And in conjunction with North Korea's recent long-range tests, are they a long way from being able to drop a nuclear bomb?
Yeah, I mean, this is the crucial point, really. Some analysts have said today that it's about time that the US administration started treating the North Korean regime in the same way as it treats other nuclear powers around the world. But the crucial difference is that obviously it's very difficult to say for certain because North Korea is such a secretive state, but most people who know something about the country agree that North Korea is still quite a long way from being able to miniaturize its nuclear warheads to the sort of size that would be required to then attach them to a long-range ballistic missile. And even though the North Koreans have test-fired ballistic missiles, of course, early last month and also a few years ago, those tests haven't been particularly successful. And although the biggest of their missiles, the Taepodong-2, is theoretically capable of reaching Hawaii and Alaska, in practice, it hasn't really shown any signs at all of being able to do that. It does have an arsenal of medium-range and short-range missiles, which, of course, would be capable of reaching South Korea and Japan. But as far as an intercontinental ballistic missile is concerned, at least one that can carry a nuclear device, I think they're still a long way off.
Here's a difficult question for you, Justin. This move from posture of negotiation to confrontation, what's behind it? What is the motivation? Do we know?
Yes, it's always very difficult to get inside the head of the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, but I think it's fair to say that having been condemned by the UN Security Council last month after the long-range ballistic missile test, and indeed having had sanctions imposed on North Korea after its first nuclear test in October 2006. What's really been happening since then is that the regime has been, well, first of all, attempted to engage the Bush administration in some sort of bilateral talks, trying to negotiate massive economic and fuel aid in return for giving up its nuclear weapons program. Now, that didn't work out. And given Barack Obama's swift response to the test and the fact that the UN Security Council has met to talk about the crisis, I think that it's fair to say that North Korea has achieved that aim, at least.
At these talks, the UN Security Council being convened, as you say, China and Russia also calling for talks. Aid packages haven't worked. Sanctions haven't worked. What can be done?
It's very difficult. It seems that the international community is running out of options. You know, one of the first things that Barack Obama did after he became president was to send Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, to Asia. She came to Japan first, and she made it very clear then that the new administration in Washington was willing to wipe the slate clean and wanted to have a fresh start with North Korea, to talk through the problems that the Bush administration had failed to resolve. And that had absolutely no impact whatsoever. So it's difficult to know what will happen next. One of the things that China has been pressing for, and this perhaps may offer, you know, some hope of progress, is for the North Koreans to return to the six-party nuclear talks in Beijing. Last month, the Koreans walked out of those talks after the UN Security Council condemnation of their missile test and has said that it won't return. But if China, which is obviously North Korea's biggest ally and certainly one of its biggest aid donors, is asking North Korea to reconsider and to return to the negotiating table, then that may have more impact than simple condemnations from countries like the US, Japan and the UK.
The Guardian's Justin McCurry in Tokyo. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, Dave Gilmore and Ronan Keating are set to record a track in support of Gary McKinnon, who's fighting extradition to the States for hacking into US military and NASA computers. More at theguardian.co.uk/technology. History is boring, if the declining numbers of students studying the subject is anything to go by. Details at guardian.co.uk/education. And the good news story for the day, charity shops are enjoying a recession boom. Details of that at guardian.co.uk/business.
From guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Next, to the hallowed or perhaps tainted halls of Westminster, where MPs and peers are eager to be seen moving forward to ameliorate their collective sullied reputation. Sir Nicholas and Anne Winterton are stepping down at the next election. Ed Miliband says major reform is the only way to restore the public's faith in the system. And the Health Secretary, Alan Johnson, has called for a referendum on electoral reform, as The Guardian's political correspondent Allegra Stratton explains.
He's of the view that if you shake up how you get MPs into Parliament, you might increase voter engagement at a time when apathy was already bad. Political apathy has been with us for quite a long time, but is in danger of turning into complete crisis with this expense problem. I've always recently been wondering exactly how constitutional reform will solve a problem born of expenses. But the argument someone like Johnson uses is that if you have people newly reassured that the vote they cast will be reflected in who they send to Parliament, then you might begin to reverse the problem we've had over the last few weeks with people feeling really disconnected from MPs who you know they just couldn't believe would fiddle a system in the way they have done. And the way in which you'd make it more representative is through something called AV Plus. But the idea is that under the current system, it's simply the person who gets the most votes who gets in, which means if sort of 20,000 people cast a vote for a Lib Dem, but 21,000 people cast a vote for a Tory person, then all those, that very large number of people who cast a vote for Lib Dem are disenfranchised effectively. So that's why they want to change it.
So Alan Johnson's rosy view of the future of democracy, it's called Alternative Vote Plus. Can you explain that?
It was something dreamt up by Lord Jenkins, who was asked by Blair 10 years ago, now over 10 years ago, to go away and think up a way of reforming the current first-past-the-post system. And what Jenkins came up with was, as far as I can see, a sort of 4/5 first-past-the-post, 1/5 proportional representation, where you'd have essentially two ballots. The first would be basically electing someone in the way you used to, so casting your vote as usual. But then there would also be a top-up, or what he's called a corrective, where sort of there would be space for those people on party lists in a region to also, if for instance you wanted to vote Lib Dem, but you hadn't, but your MP returned from your constituency wasn't Lib Dem, but you cast a Lib Dem vote, that would go to the regional list and you would get, in accordance with however many people also voted Lib Dem, you would get some proportional representation of the Lib Dem votes in that area.
So if you had one vote for your constituency representative and one for your political party, does that mean more MPs or the same number?
I think it would mean the same number of MPs. It's just there would be a reduction. I mean, that's one of the problems with the system, that what you're then bringing in are two different types of MPs, and who has greater legitimacy? Is the one that's elected via PR the one with the greater legitimacy, or is the one in the old system having the greater legitimacy? So it is. That's why it's a fudge, and that's why at the time in 1998 it was technically shelved.
Would these reforms help the likes of Esther Ranson and now David Van Day, who is considering standing?
I don't think so, because I think an Esther is standing because of the exact system as she sees it. She thinks that you have no chance in the current system of getting in. Even if you get 10% of the votes, you have no chance of getting in, and so you have no chance of being a corrective to whatever party is in power, or whatever one of the three main parties. Whereas if you have a system where someone like Esther could get 15% of the vote and so get in, I think she would say that, that Parliament would probably be a more pluralist place, and therefore there wouldn't be a need for someone like her. She's standing because she knows she has a high profile, and she knows the particular case of Margaret Moran, where she's trying to possibly stand against, also has a high profile, and so she thinks she'll get in, and then once in be able to be a corrective. But I think if you had a changed voting system in the, you know, certainly if you had pure PR, you'd have more people like Esther, you'd have people less famous than Esther, you'd also, and this is the thing people are talking about at the moment, have probably people like the BNP, you'd probably have Kashmiri Internationalist Party as well, you'd have a lot of different voices depending on the particular interests of constituencies around the country that are not all the same.
The Guardian's political correspondent, Allegra Stratton. I'm Mike Durand. Still to come on today's podcast, from the Hayfest, a light-hearted lesson in Pestonianism, as the BBC's business editor, Robert Peston, talks about Robert Peston.
Talking to Robert Peston is the most exciting thing I've ever done in my entire career. This could be the biggest moment of your life.
It is. No, in many ways it is.
But you're not projecting that. Let's be clear.
And Chris Blackwell on the Island Records protégé, Bob Marley.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Before that, we get our hands dirty in some 400,000-year-old dirt. But as you'd expect from Guardian Daily, this isn't just any old muck, as included in it is what has been dubbed the stone that shattered the time barrier. Archaeologists say it nullifies the Bible's creation story in the same way as fossil Eda did only recently. I asked the Guardian's Maeve Kennedy how a lump of flint can challenge creationist history.
It's a very old lump of flint. I mean, obviously, as a lump of flint, it's millions of years old. But probably around 400,000 years ago, somebody picked this lump of flint up, tried to make it into a cutting tool, hit a flaw in the flint, said, oh, sod that, and chucked it away half finished. And it ended up a long way down, 11 feet down, in a quarry in France, where it was found by two workmen, who immediately sent a telegram. In those days before Twittering, the telegram got to the people in about 10 minutes flat, so quickly that they abandoned their lunch and travelled the 30 miles by post chaise to get to the quarry, to find this axe still buried deep in the layers. And that's the significance of it. It's the first man-made tool that was found in situ by scientists who actually saw it still so far down that it couldn't be a fake, it couldn't have been planted there. And, because the date is 1859, it was photographed. So it is the first archaeological site photograph of the first absolutely definitive man-made tool recorded in situ. And to the absolute rapture of the scientists, it was just what they were looking for. This is a particularly dull-looking layer of quarry, I have to say. It's not a glamorous place like the old Juvai Gorge, which later produced tools hundreds of thousands of years older than this one. But what was in this same layer was mashed up bits of fossil bones from extinct animals like woolly mammoth and rhino, which you probably wouldn't any longer bump into if you happen to be just outside Amiens in northern France. They're in this same layer. They've got 11 feet of rock and shale on top of them. So bingo, the Bible story can't be true. The world can't have been created in 4,040 years. There are animals which are clearly thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of years older than that. And there's a man-made tool in the middle of them. And so the whole Bible story falls to pieces immediately.
Creationists are going to be reeling, aren't they? News of this, and also recently this so-called missing link in evolution, the fossil Eda.
Well, of course, Eda makes this stone tool look like a blink in an angel's eye. I mean, Eda is just so old. Eda would have been buried a long, long, long time before anybody picked up this piece of fossil. It is completely extraordinary that, to me, that 150 years after scientists found this thing and thought, that's it, done and dusted, we finally have the proof, that people are still arguing about it. It is really fascinating. It challenges something so deep in human nature. It did in 1859 when the scientists who found this gave their first lecture on the flint. It does now when fossils like Eda turn up. I think it's that fairy tale thing that we want a comforting, simple story to rock us to sleep in a very difficult, frightening world, and people are very reluctant to give it up.
Maeve Kennedy talking about a lump of flint. And you might also be interested that a cast of fossil Eda is set to be displayed at the Natural History Museum. Next to Hay, where The Guardian's Stephen Moss has been getting lessons in how to speak Robert Peston, or Pestonian, to give it the correct moniker. The darling of BBC Business News drew a large crowd at the festival as the credit crunch cult hero. He says the secret to his popular presentation style is quite simple.
I do get excited when I'm, you know, doing stuff, talking about stuff that I'm excited about. Mm. And so I'm sure that is then translated into the way that I do things.
You seem to pause on the little words, and then the big words, you almost hurry through them. So of seems to be a key word.
I think that's a thinking thing. I just have always done this thing of sort of, you know, thinking and speaking more or less simultaneously, which yeah. can be... So you have to devise strategies to make sure that what comes out isn't completely so stupid. So you just... you put, and so it does mean occasionally, I guess, the pauses go in slightly odd places because you're holding on a word, making sure that you're about, what you're about to say actually is rational.
So my boring, unsuccessful monotone, how can I get a more Pestonian delivery?
Haven't you just got to get excited about what you're doing? I think that's all it is. I just think you've just got to sort of, your brain has to fizz a bit more about, you've got to think, talking to Robert Peston is the most exciting thing I've ever done in my entire career. That's what you,
So I'm too laid back.
You're too laid back. You just take it all in your stride. It's not, you know, this moment, this could be the biggest moment of your life.
It is. No, in many ways it is.
And, I mean, you know, and but you're not projecting that. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
You're not getting that across. Okay. I'm not feeling that from you.
Okay. Okay. So it's really the voice has to go up and down, yes?
Yeah, it appears to.
And extending certain words.
I think you have got to... I think you've probably got to be completely rubbish at where you put your emphasis. I think that's quite important. I think because there are times I notice when, I don't know when we play that back how terrible that will sound, but it is certainly true that sometimes the words I stress are not the ones that everybody stresses.
So it's not RADA. It's not the RADA school of.
It certainly isn't. It appears to be the Robert Peston eccentric school.
Okay, so give me five tips. Get excited.
The three things you have to do is you have to immerse yourself in the story so that you feel you own it, okay? Mm. And so the journalism does come first. It's about, you have to sort of, you know, you have to live the story and you have to feel that the story matters and, you know, you have to feel that you own it. Right? Mm. It's your story. It's nobody else's story, right? So that's one thing, right? And that requires an incredible amount of work. Secondly, you have to be clear, and you can't fake this, that the story matters. Okay, you have to be, you have to genuinely be excited by it, and that you can't, you know, you can't create excitement if you don't really genuinely believe that it sort of, you know, the story matters. Mm. And then I guess you've got to just be, you know, unselfconscious, I'm afraid, about, you know. You know, I think I am a better, ghastly phrase, presenter, you know, which is what you're supposed to be on TV. You're supposed to be a presenter. We're all supposed to be presenters. I'm a better presenter than I was. I think I do, come across as slightly less eccentric than I did, and I think I do less of accentuating the wrong words. But actually, at the end of the day, you've got to be true to yourself, and being true to yourself in my case is occasionally... you know, accentuating ways and words in a way that others would see as eccentric, then, you know, don't worry about it. It's just how you are. So do I sit at home thinking, how can I make myself sound even crazier?
Believe it or not, he doesn't. I can guarantee that. Nor does he dye his hair, by the way.
Okay, we'll stress that.
Absolutely on the record. You heard it from the horse's mouth.
But over breakfast he sounds this way? Is that not very exhausting?
No, he's got a normal, perfectly, I think, perfectly pleasant, normal, I think, personally, rather attractive way of speaking.
Yeah.
A very nice, modulated, well-spoken voice, which his mother was a speech therapist, and his mother's made them all speak very nicely. When he started doing the broadcasting, it baffled me why he suddenly is and completely mad, manic delivery, because that is not how he speaks.
Yeah.
And the which the boys make fun of a lot.
Can you do Peston?
In the style of
your father.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by posing, end them to die to sleep.
11-year-old Max Peston, son of Robert, ending that report by The Guardian's Stephen Moss. And you can hear more from the festival in our Haycast at guardian.co.uk/Haycast. Finally, to make sure you are fully aware of another ongoing series at Guardian Online, this one celebrating Island Records' 50 years. We have for you now part of an interview with the company founder Chris Blackwell. All this week, stars from the label will be performing in London, and London only, I'm afraid. Tonight, Sly and Robbie and Grace Jones are among those appearing at the Shepherd's Bush Empire. Cat Stevens, Paul Weller and Amy Winehouse are some of the others on stage over the next 5 days. Here we hear Chris Blackwell talking about the early days of Bob Marley's career at the label.
I went out to Jamaica, and it was the trip when Bob and Peter and Bunny had just about finished the first album. And I hadn't heard anything yet. I had no idea what songs they were doing, anything. So they picked me up at a hotel and drove me around to the studio. And they played me all the tracks. The first track they played me was Slave Driver, because I remember thinking, wow, this is incredible. And also that the second line of it was Catch a Fire. And I thought maybe it could be a great album title for something fresh like this. So they played Concrete Jungle, which was the most complex Jamaican song structure that I'd ever heard. I was so excited when I heard that, just the changes of it, the whole arrangement of it. Then they played another song, and it was a sort of balladish song, a softish song. It was nice, but the thing in my head that I felt was essential for them was to come as rebels. And this song was just such a sweet song. So we went through other songs, Midnight Ravers, the Peter Tosh songs, Stop That Train, We Don't Need No Trouble. They were all sort of like had a real rebel feel. So I left off this song and forgot about this song, this gentle song. Forgot about it really until probably a couple of years ago. And we're talking now 2009. And this was recorded, I'd heard it in 1972. That's not to say that no other people didn't know about it, but I had completely forgotten about it. And that's a song called High Tide, Low Tide, which is one of the sweetest songs of Bob's.
And to listen to the whole of the series this week, go to guardian.co.uk/music. That is it for today's podcast. John Dennis is back tomorrow. Producing today, Adam Gabbett and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.